And welcome to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. Welcome to the show. So it's May. Spring is in full flight, and basically plants are exploding with their green leaves and their flowers, and birds are migrating, and birds are breeding, and animals are having their babies, and you know, love is in the air, and there's all kinds of new growth. And one thing that is very interesting in St. Anne de Bellevue that McGill University is affiliated with is the McGill Bird Observatory, where they study migrating birds, primarily through putting up mist nets where they capture migrating birds at this time of year. And once they capture them, they weigh them, they measure them, they look for any important characteristics, and then they put a small band on them, and then they release them. And if somebody catches them again, or if somebody finds that bird later on dead and is able to retrieve the band, or at least read the band, get the number, then researchers are able to track that bird, you know, where it was banded, where it ended up, at the end of its life, or where it was captured again at a different banding station. And there are banding stations all over North America. And in Quebec, the primary two that I'm aware of are the McGill Bird Observatory site and the one in Tadoussac, north, quite far north from here. So we are going to feature an interview I did last year with Simon Duval. And Simon Duval is the coordinator of the McGill Bird Observatory. And he is currently banding now every morning at sunup. He's there until June 1st doing the migration monitoring at the McGill Bird Observatory, which happens at the Stony Croft Wildlife Area right adjacent to the Morgan Arboretum in St. Anne de Bellevue. And they just recently had their open house. They had their open house yesterday morning. And I was there, but this interview is not with Simon then, but with him last year. But all the same information is still relevant today. So if you are ever interested in learning more about the McGill Bird Observatory, they are on Facebook. I think you find them by looking for Observatoire d'Oiseau de McGill. And also you can go to their website, which is oommbo.org. So that's it. So here is my interview with Simon Duval, who is the coordinator of the McGill Bird Observatory. We're here with Simon Duval, who is the coordinator of the McGill Bird Observatory. How are you doing today, Simon?
I'm doing good.
I guess just start off by telling me, you know, what's the history of the McGill Bird Observatory?
So McGill Bird Observatory was started in 2004 as a pilot project. Some graduate student from the McDonald campus were looking for a site to band northern saw-whet owls to try to monitor their population. They got exposed to that at Prince Edward Point Bird Observatory in Ontario. And so they found this site, the Stony Croft Wildlife Area, that's just off the campus, which looked like a really decent site to do that. And so they gave, you know, owl banding a try. It didn't work out really good, but they figured that during the day it was really good for songbirds. So they just said, well, instead of that, we'll you know, give it a try for songbird migration monitoring. And it turned out to be a success.
So what's the main work that the McGill Bird Observatory does for the past however many years now?
Yeah, so since 2005, we've been doing migration monitoring. So mostly spring and fall migration. And it's a standardized protocol. So it means that we're doing the same thing, the same dates every year, you know, banding with the same nets at the same hours, in order to be able to sort of check our data like throughout the time be able to tell, you know, species that are increasing or declining. So we focus on that. And in the last decade, we've added a summer program to monitor our breeding population. So we follow the MAPS protocol. So it's monitoring avian productivity and survivorship. So it's a North American program to check on breeding birds. And we do a little bit of winter monitoring too at the feeders to try to see which proportion of our resident birds stay on site and which individual. And so we can look at that when we analyze data sort of year round. Yeah.
And if I were to ask you, you know, what you like about, you know, doing the work you do at the McGill Bird Observatory, what would you say?
You know, we do the same thing every day, but every day is so different. You know, migration is this really wonderful thing where you can go out on a day and see almost no migrants because, you know, the conditions were bad and they're all sheltered and you just can't find them. And then the next day you come in and they're just everywhere. Like there was this really good, strong arrival. So I think it's that sort of, you know, surprise in the morning of you never know what you're going to get. That's the part I like the most, I think, about the work.
You know, if you were trying to encourage kids to get interested in it, like what would you say that, you know, elementary school kids would find cool about it, or
about the migration,
or just about what the McGill Bird Observatory does?
Yeah, well, it's one opportunity to see birds up close, which we almost never do. And, you know, the majority of the birds that we catch are migrants. So they don't breed here. They breed in the boreal forest. So our only chance of seeing them in southern Quebec is during that spring or fall migration. And you know, generally, you know, very colorful warblers will be very high up in trees. And it's kind of hard to be able to see them and witness the beauty of them. But when we do banding, we get them in the hand and we can look at the plumage criteria. And I think it's a really interesting and fast way to get interested in birds.
Well, what are some of the threats to birds? And then what is it about the West Island that maybe creates a little bit of a refuge for breeding birds and migrating birds?
So there are many threats to birds nowadays. Most of them are related to humans, of course. You know, window collisions or cat predation, mortality when they hit power lines and cars, and you know that's all related to humans. So I'd say those are the biggest threats. You know, of course, other predators is also a threat to songbirds. What makes the West Island special is sort of in the west of the island of Montreal, it's really the only major sort of green belt that's still available for songbirds to rest during migration and, you know, refuel, eat. So I think they really like to follow that sort of west green belt along the way.
Tell me, you know, some of the neat things that you've discovered while working there.
Well, there are many neat things. You know, one of the cool things that we found in just the last 16 years that we've been doing this is that in just those 16 years, some species have shifted their migration in fall, for example, already, you know, a couple of weeks. You know, we have a species like American Red Start, which, you know, breeds in southern Quebec, but also north of us. When we first started in 2004, they used to peak for fall migration somewhere around the third week of August, sometimes the fourth week of August. In the last few years, they've been peaking in the first week of August, and we have a feeling that, you know, in the next 5 years, they'll peak in late July. So that's kind of cool to see this species really shifting its migration, you know, much earlier. The reason is it's actually doing that, we have no idea. And it's not like the observatory is not there to answer these questions. It's more there to witness that and, you know, maybe ring a bell to say there's something going on with that species. Maybe we should look into it.
And what about individual birds that you've banded, you know, a number of times and what you maybe have learned about the bird that way?
Well, we have some resident birds that we band and recapture very often. Some chickadees in the fall we'll see almost every week, and some of them live quite old. Like we find out that chickadees can very well live, you know, up to 5, 6, 7, or 8 years without any problems. And during those 8 years, you know, we may recapture them 60 or 70 times, you know, so we can look at their weight change and the way they accumulate fat, you know, per season. So we can really sort of get a glimpse of the annual life cycle of, you know, a common bird like black-capped chickadees.
And describe the site for me a bit, the McGill Bird Observatory site.
So the McGill Bird Observatory site is a really cool site where it's sort of a mix of many different habitats. To the north, we have a mature forest, a maple forest. And so we're sort of surrounded by, to the north, by the Morgan Arboretum. To the east, we have the McDonald Farm fields, so, you know, very open land. And the actual site is made of, you know, mostly a kind of a shrubby field area with, you know, patches of shrub, but also a patch of open grass field. And then, you know, within that patch of shrubs, we have two big wetlands, one of which is a permanent cattail marsh, you know, typical. And the other ones are spring ponds, which, you know, flood in the spring, but get very dry in the fall. So that sort of mix and match of all the habitat makes every species find sort of its niche on the site.
And that was my interview with Simon Duval, who is the coordinator of the McGill Bird Observatory in Sainte-Anne-de-Bellevue, Quebec, and is affiliated, of course, with McGill University. And they are currently banding lots of migrating birds every morning until June 1st, I believe, at their site, which is adjacent to the Morgan Arboretum. And if you want to find out more about their organization, you can go to oommbo.org. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Ryan Young, and we're going to feature a talk now from Joe Roman. And Joe Roman is a conservation biologist and researcher at the University of Vermont. And his research focuses on endangered species conservation and marine ecology. And today we are going to feature a talk which he gave about whales at Harvard University. And he actually received his PhD from Harvard in 2003 in organismic and evolutionary biology. So here is his talk about conserving the great whales, and also, you know, trying to explain what role whales play in the larger marine ecosystem.
Over the years, I've spent many hours thinking about how we can get at looking at the ecological role of whales. How do whales impact the oceans? And more importantly, how do we actually analyze that? So today I'll talk about that. All right, so for much of human history, this is all we would have seen of a whale. You'd see a blow, an exhalation, maybe a few meters, can be up to 5-6 meters in the air, a glint on the back, and then for the buoyant whales, they'd throw up their fluke and sink below the surface. So we really didn't know what was going on beneath that surface. It led to speculation about what the oceans were like. And in a way, this can be a metaphor for our understanding of the oceans. Seeming limitless horizon. We thought the oceans themselves were limitless. It wasn't until recently that we started to understand the limits of that ocean and start, and I'll talk about that today, really getting an idea of what's going on beneath the surface. For me, a whale, a leviathan, a cetacean, historically, would be any animal depicted with a spout. So you can see them up on the left there. Some humans were afraid of whales. You can see them throwing things off the boat at them. The Norwegians thought that the breath of a whale was poisonous. If you breathed it in, it could kill you. Any of you that have ever smelled right whale breath might feel the same way. It's fallen on you. And here on the lower right, you can see what was described as a leviathan. And there are actually fins on the claws of this whale. This came from a mistranslation from Swedish to Latin. And even though no one had actually seen it, it was a mistranslation for the word for claws was mistranslated to, rather for fins was mistranslated to claws. even though no one had ever seen them, it persisted in the literature for hundreds of years, even to the French Academy into the 1700s. There was one way that we could see whales up close, and that is when they stranded. The other way that we've really had a long-term relationship with whales, dating back at least to 2000 BC, is through whaling. That is, people going out and actually hunting them. This is from a petroglyph, a cave drawing, a cave carving from Korea, dating back to 2000 BC. And you can see a boat of men tethered to a whale, probably a gray whale or a right whale. Can't necessarily get that from the drawing, but those were the two coastal whales that were heavily harvested at that, or that were harvested at that time. We don't have any evidence for the first couple of thousands of years of hunting whales that populations were affected. That is, of course, individual whales were affected, but we don't see any evidence that whales might have started to disappear until our relationship shifted around 1000 AD. So the first commercial whaling receipt that we know of is from 1000 AD. It's from Basque whalers that sold whale tongue for meat. Whales were originally harvested for their food, and whale tongue was considered a delicacy. Whales were considered fish, so they could be consumed during Lent. And therefore, they were hunted for that, and also for their oil. And in the case of mysticetes, whales that are filter feeders, their baleen was very valuable. It was used for skirt hoops, for bed springs, umbrellas, basically anything that now we'd use, maybe spring steel or plastic, they would be using that baleen at that time. These whales were hunted for at least 1,000 years. Sperm whales are odontocetes. They're related to porpoises and killer whales. They weren't really hunted commercially until around the 1700s. It was a Yankee fishery right off the coast here, and then eventually it led to hunts around the world. The mysticetes were hunted for baleen. The sperm whales were prized for their oil, their clean burning oil. They lit writers' garrets, they lit houses. This was the oil that was used for lighthouses, for street lamps. In fact, until recently in North Carolina, until about 70 years ago, it was required that whale oil or dolphin oil was used to light the lighthouses there. That only changed about 70 or 80 years ago. Whales were money at this point. So sperm whales used to light the night. But the main product for baleen in the past couple of hundred years would never see the light of day. And that was for women's corsets. This drove men around the world to harvest baleen. It was so valuable, the baleen from a single bowhead whale in the Pacific, in the North Pacific. It was worth the journey going all the way around South America and up to the North Pacific, and you could pay for that just from a single adult bowhead whale. So if you got several whales, that's when you started making a lot of money. The fashion started in the 1550s by Mary Tudor in Britain, and then was taken by Catherine de Medici in France. She wasn't going to be beat out by Britain in the realm of fashion, so she declared the ideal waist size as 13 inches for women. That's right. So you can see that wasp waist. Women paid for this. You could have floating ribs. It could affect breathing, your organs. It had real health effects on women. And this lasted until the 1870s or 1880s, when it finally started to go out of fashion. As bad as it was for women, it was worse for the whale, of course. This shows you baleen plates from bowhead whales in the Arctic oil works in San Francisco, on a wharf in San Francisco. And in the 1800s, more than 4 million pounds of baleen was being brought into U.S. ports each year, worth millions of dollars. And at that time, and this really did continue, it was serial depletion. They weren't looking at sustainability here. The point was you go in, you get as many as you can, you hope your competitors don't know where you're going, and then you move on. So there'd be serial depletion of populations around the world, really. This hunt led people to remote islands all around. So in the 20th century, by the 19th century, some whale populations were depleted, right whales and bowheads. By the 20th century, we had the rise of industrial whaling. And now we see all a serial depletion of different species. The first whale to be hunted was the blue whale in the 20th century, using these factory ships that could be basically rendering the whales off of the Antarctic using diesel catcher boats that would speedily go after the whale. They'd harpoon the whale, bring it back, and it was brought up the stern slipway. Incredibly efficient, and whale populations paid the price. Blue whales, why were the first ones hunted? Largest animals ever to exist on the planet. Incredibly valuable, each individual. Over time, you see this decline here, World War II, bad time to be a human, maybe a good time to be a whale. For a little bit, for a couple of years, they get a break from hunting because these the diesel catcher boats were used to hunt U-2 boats in the North Pacific, rather in the North Atlantic. And in the North Pacific, the larger factory ships were used to bring small planes to Hawaii to attack Pearl Harbor. They used those ships. After World War II, the hunt continues like it hadn't before, and we see a serial depletion of species, fin whales, humpback whales, sei whales, and then by the 1970s, the small minkies. In the beginning, they're using these products for oil. By the end, the sperm whale is still being hunted for lubricants in jet engines and in submarines, but these species were largely hunted for margarine, for pet food, for fertilizer. It really was questionable whether we should be hunting these species at that time. And it was brought into the international courts, into the National Whaling Commission. There were arguments that we should stop hunting whales, the hunter's dilemma. Some countries, Norway, Japan, Iceland, argued to continue whaling, even though populations were low. And many other countries, the United States, for example, many European countries, New Zealand, Australia, argued for a complete commercial moratorium. And that occurred in the 1980s. We had a commercial moratorium on whales that's still in existence today. A few countries continued to whale. Iceland and Norway have withdrawn, have taken themselves out of the IWC, or filed objections. And Japan continues to hunt under a loophole that was actually put in place by the United States. In the 1960s, we closed down hunting of gray whales in the United States. The loophole was that gray whales were still allowed to be hunted scientifically, and that has been the guise that the Japanese have been operating under, that it's scientific whaling. If you kill the whale for scientific purposes, you can eat the product after. You can eat the whale meat, and it's sold throughout Japan. So in the 1990s, some conservation groups wondered if viewed from the United States' point of view, hypocrisy of hunting whales under the guise of scientific whaling actually might also extend to that Japan was hunting whales that actually were illegal, that shouldn't be hunted. Was pirate whaling going on? So in the 1990s, Scott Baker, Steve Palumbi, who was here, and I worked with him when he was here, and several other researchers set up a DNA lab in Tokyo. This is Naoko Funahashi. She was Japanese national. She went around the country of Japan buying samples from sushi bars, from supermarkets, from various places, and then putting them if she was in a sushi bar, as soon as the chef would turn his back, she would put it in her jacket and take it away, bring it to a hotel room in Tokyo where a DNA lab was set up. Why not bring those samples to the United States? Whales are protected. You need an export permit and an import permit. The United States Japan wasn't going to give a bunch of meddling American and New Zealand scientists a chance to bring these out and see what they were. I joined them in the late 1990s in Tokyo to work on this project. You can see the Do Not Disturb sign there. They were in a hotel with white powder and all these high-end equipment and never let anybody in the room. There was no housekeeping for 2 or 3 weeks that entire time. I don't know what they were thinking we were doing back there. No one ever busted us at that point. So there, the samples were purchased. Then artificial copies using PCR were made, and then those copies were brought. These artificial copies were brought to labs in New Zealand and Hawaii, and Harvard as well, to see what was being sold on the marketplace. What they found would dwarf the life list of most whale biologists that are being sold on that market. These indicate pirate whaling, illegal whaling. If it's in black, these are the scientific whaling. So many samples, Pacific minke, Antarctic minke, and Brutus whales, but here's the disturbing point. Species that have been protected since the 1980s, 1960s, sperm whale protected since the 1937, they are all showing up on the Japanese market. So this protection is not working, and it questions the Japanese hunt at this time. So at this point, I was working, as Jim had mentioned, I was at the University of Florida when I joined Baker in Japan. And the Japanese at that point were arguing that hunting whales actually helped people. It helped fisheries. Not only did it help people, but it helped the whales themselves. This was on the Japanese, the website for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Until last year, I actually looked today and did not find the slide. So until last year, this has been up there. Whales are increasing. That's serious competition for fisheries, for humans. And it also means that it's endangering other whale species. Why is that? Minke whale populations have increased while other species are depleted. Minke whales are eating. I was wondering, is that true? It hasn't gotten much traction. The question is that really true? Is there competition here? Is there competition with humans and also with other whale species? So again, I was at the University of Florida at that point studying marine ecology and learning about basic precepts of marine ecology, including the biological pump. The idea behind that is photosynthesis occurs at the surface where there's light, but organic matter, carbon, and also nitrogen, iron, other nutrients, sink out of the system when organisms die or through fecal particles. So you've got this very classic idea of a biological pump. I was sitting in the back of the room, half paying attention in class, when I thought, there's something missing here. Something missing in the system. And it dates back from work that I did at the New England Aquarium years before studying right whales. So this, a couple of years ago, we insulated our attic, and I found my notes from my marine ecology class. And what I wrote here, so in the back of that room, biological pump, it's like right whales, which I had been studying with colleagues at the New England Aquarium, actually come up to the surface in the Bay of Fundy with mud on their heads. They go down, they feed at depth, they come to the surface, and very often, what do you see when they dive? A fecal plume. They poop at the surface. They release what I thought is probably nutrients into the surface that can be picked up by phytoplankton and copepods. You could tell I was a graduate student at that time because it says here 12:30, eat. I had to remind myself to eat at that point. So, like many of this was an idea that I had, I was working on other projects. You know, at that point I was working on alligator snapping turtles, and then I came back to Harvard and I was working on genetics of whales. But in the back of my mind, I'd always had this idea. It wasn't until I sat down with Jim and we tried to plot out a way to actually look at this. Is this important, biologically important? As a colleague of ours, Dick Barber, would say, is it an ecologically important process, or is it just a fart in a hurricane? Right? So how important is this? Whales were feeding at depth where there wasn't any light, coming to the surface and releasing nutrients there and allowing phytoplankton, releasing nitrogen, which is important in the Gulf of Maine, and iron in the southern hemisphere. And here you can see a dive pattern for whales. What's starting to change at this point in the past couple of years, incredible technology about understanding what whales are doing at depth. We're moving from that initial image that I showed where you just saw breath at the surface and our understanding of whales was maybe 10% of their lives, a small part of their lives. We're finally getting to a point where we know what's going on, or we're starting to see what's going on beneath the surface. So Jim and I put out a paper, or rather we put out a manuscript, submitted a manuscript, looking at the role of whales in, of marine mammals, whales and other marine mammals in the Gulf of Maine. And we found, we calculated that they return about 24,000 metric tons of nitrogen per year to the surface. That's more than all rivers combined. Evidence that this is ecologically important. Not as much as atmospheric deposition, that is through industrial pollution. The humans put a lot, release a lot of nitrogen into the air, but comparable to coastal point sources. Anyone know what a coastal point source is? Human sewage. Yeah, so it's comparable to human sewage. But they're putting it, whales are releasing it in biologically productive areas. They're releasing this nitrogen in areas where they're feeding, in areas of hot spots. So we submitted that, and it got rejected. And in fact, one of the reasons was one of the reviewers said, "You guys are right there. You're at Harvard. You're right there near the Gulf of Maine. Why didn't you haven't you gone out and actually collected some of this poop and analyzed it?" And if you guys have worked in science, like, oh, well, this is going to be a lot of work. Like, so here we have a model. Now we're actually going to have to go out and collect this stuff and look at it.
So what does that mean?
Well, one of the worst jobs in science, according to popular science, is whale feces researcher, going out and collecting this stuff. This was drawn, I think, mostly for Roz Rolland, who I'll talk about, and Scott Krause, who've been doing a lot of work looking at stress levels in whales. Anybody, any idea what the worst is that year anyway? Hazmat diver. So diving in sewage, even worse than going out and collecting these samples. Fortunately, colleagues of mine, so it's not always so easy to find, as easy to find whale feces as you might expect, because they're not defecating every time. You know, there may be periods when they're going and periods when they're not. Roz Rolland and Scott Krause and their colleagues thought of a unique way that they might optimize finding the number of samples, though. And that is using scat-detecting dogs. A Rottweiler that started his career as a companion animal, and when it was an elderly woman, when she died, he became a sniffer dog in a prison in Washington State. And then I think he got his dream job, what every dog's dream job might be, which is a sniffer dog on land looking for grizzly scats and other scats. And then the crazy idea was, if it works on land, maybe it should work on the ocean as well. Fargo's limitation was he got seasick, so he had to have Dramamine before he went out. And his colleague, Bob, was terrified of whales. So Bob would just go to the bottom of the boat when a whale came, surface near it. This is the North Atlantic right here, right whale here, by the way. But what's amazing is it did increase the amount of samples that they found when they were looking for this. Here you can see a track of how Fargo is finding these samples. So here's a scent cone, same thing as dogs have on land. They're downwind of a sample or of what they're looking for, and they're going upwind. And if they're excited, then you know you're on the scent. Fargo is a Rottweiler, tiny little tail. They used to call it the Happy Inch, I'll tell you. So when the Happy Inch was moving, Fargo would be excited. Then that X means he's off the mark. He's not smelling it anymore. He's sitting down. He's relaxed. You get that sign again. That means he's smelling it indication. And the driver's got to figure this out. You've got to be going upwind. You're dealing with currents. This is the Bay of Fundy. So again, he's out. And then this circle indicates where humans can smell it. Right whale feces is really pungent, so even at 100 meters, humans can smell it. And then eventually, you find that sample. And many more samples were found when Fargo was on board than not. Some of these samples we analyzed that were collected by Scott and Roz Rolland. Other samples we collected, we connected humpback whale samples from here in Stellwagen Bank, basically hitchhiking along another project which I'll show you in a moment. I do want to tell you about some really interesting results that came from this study from Raz and Scott. One was when they were working out in the water in September 11, 2001. You know what happened on September 11th. Tragedy on land, but things got really quiet on the oceans because there was no commercial transit in that area. And there had been concerns for a long time that noise in the ocean causes stress in animals, right whales and other whales. And they were able to look at the data before 9/11 and after 9/11 and see indications that the hormones declined when things quieted down. Some indication that they are stressed when you're having all this noise and shipping activity in those areas. These stress hormones can inhibit the immune system and stunt growth, so it can have an effect on these animals. So this nitrogen cycling is important across the board, but it's especially important in the summer when whales are abundant and a thermocline is formed. So what happens is during the winter, you've got a well-mixed water column. In the summer, when the surface water heats up, you've got what's called a thermocline, and the phytoplankton at the surface start to use up those nutrients. You have the nutrients at the bottom. What are the whales doing? Diving beneath that thermocline often and feeding and releasing feces there. So this activity is most important in the summer when you have that thermocline. That's when whales are pumping those nutrients into the surface. We call this a whale pump. So even that first time when I started thinking about this, there was one question. I was going out with my colleagues at the New England Aquarium. There were maybe 350 right whales in the whole North Atlantic. I mean, how important is that when you have so few whales? What about when there were 10,000, though? What about when whales were abundant before they were hunted? How would they have affected the oceans at that point? As it turns out, that's when things really matter, is when you have, of course, abundant whales in the system. So here we're looking at what the nitrogen profile would look like historically when whales were abundant. Atmospheric deposition, you don't have that so much. Coastal point sources have dropped out. This is before humans are here. And whales, depending on what number you use historically, were very important in driving that system. They had a big impact on the nitrogen cycle at that point. That brings into question, I think it counters many of the claims by Japanese scientific whaling community that if we take whales out of the system, we'll have a more productive system. By taking whales out of the system, it could actually influence the productivity in that system and reduce primary productivity in areas where whales are feeding, because they're feeding on zooplankton or they're feeding on forage fish, and they're releasing those nutrients back into the surface. So the whale pump, though, these calls that they're calling for might actually be counterproductive. That is, by taking whales out of the system, you might lose productivity in those areas. So as you saw, fecal plumes are really big, right? So we can get a lot of sample from that. We were collecting it to look at nitrogen, to look at nutrients in that system, but there are lots of other things that can be done as well. So an undergraduate, Annabelle Beichmann, working with Pete Gerges and Jim McCarthy, came along to the Bay of Fundy with us and collected fecal samples to look at the microbiome. To get an idea, I promised we were going to get into the bowels of the whales, to get an idea of how whales are breaking down the food that they're eating. This is a right whale courtship group, really one of the most stunning wildlife events that I've ever seen. You've got one female, you can have 10, 20 males trying to mate with her, or at least their surface activity at that point. And as it turns out, there's inevitably poop in those large aggregations, so you can actually see that here. That ended up being we didn't have Fargo around, you'd look for a courtship group and you could collect fecal samples outside of that. The microbiome within these whales and comparing it to their artiodactyl relatives, that is, they're related to cows, they're related to hippos. How does their microbiome compare? What's amazing is you see terrestrial animals and axis of diversity of microbes in that area, whales are really different. They stand out from carnivores. They stand out from herbivores. One thing that might be going on is they're using the same metabolic pathways that their relatives, their evolutionary relatives, use to break down cellulose. They're eating cellulose on land. They're using it to break down chitin in the oceans. So we're seeing a really interesting system coming from the work of Annabelle Beichman, John Sanders, who's a postdoc, and Pete Gerges. So the big question is, how are whales ecosystem engineers? How are they impacting the oceans? Well, I've presented this one case of looking at nutrient cycling, but how else might they engineer the oceans? Ecosystem engineers, one example would be a beaver. For example, clear engineers, right? They're changing stream systems, building ponds, or oyster reefs are two good examples. We don't often think of pelagic species necessarily, free swimming species, as engineering the environment. So in 2012, I invited scientists from around the world, including Jim and Jim Estes and a whole group of people, Victor Smeduschek from Germany, Steve Nickel worked on the project from Tasmania, to address this question. How are whales influencing the oceans, and if so, how? One way that they are clearly working as engineers, actually, is humpback whales bubble feed. A bubble net is they dive beneath the surface, and when they're underneath herring or another school of fish, they release bubbles. So they're diving, making a spiral shape, and then coming into the surface and feeding on herring. So a clear sense of engineering, probably, but only lasting seconds, right? Not lasting a long time, necessarily. In contrast, some whales, like gray whales, dive to the bottom, to the benthos, and are feeding on amphipods at the bottom of the ocean. And those furrows, those ridges, can last centuries. So they're clearly impacting the bottom of the ocean as well. Another way that whales have a major impact on the oceans, and something we really didn't know about till relatively recently, till about the 1980s, is there are entire communities that are dependent on whale carcasses in the deep sea. When whales die, this is Osedax, this is a worm that is dependent on whale bones. So when whales die, different species, hagfish, scavenger species, feed on them, and then other species settle on them and spend their entire lives on the bones of these whales. This is a gray whale here off Monterey Bay, and here you can see different species. There are sea cucumbers around them as well. These communities are entirely dependent. Some of them will move, are found in different deep seas, can be found in hydrothermal vents, for example. Others have only been found on whales. What's the consequence of hunting whales is this may be some of the earliest extinctions in the sea are a result of our over-harvesting whales. Why is that? We took the habitat out, right? So we depleted whale populations, all the habitat around the oceans, by between 60 and 90%. By taking that habitat out, we removed places for these species to settle. So Craig Smith and a few colleagues and I looked at that extinction curve and found that we could have lost 15% or more species in the deep sea before we even knew they existed. Another thing that changed is when whales die, we don't have large trees in the ocean, but we have large animals. They remove a lot of carbon. When historically, during the age of whaling, we were burning those whales. We were burning the oil. We were releasing the carbon into the atmosphere. But when whales die, naturally, they're sequestering that carbon in the deep sea to the tune of about historically 200,000 tons of carbon a year were sequestered just because of these whale falls. Nowadays, we have about 30 tons of carbon a year. So here, we're starting to think about restoration. What happens if we bring those whale populations back? Here's one way of actually increasing the sequestration of carbon. It's comparable, Jim, I don't know what you'd think, to about
a reforestation of a few states in the United States. So it's a significant amount of carbon. It's not going to solve climate change, though, restoring whales. That we have to do ourselves. So far I've been talking about declines in whale populations. I want to finish up, though, and tell you the good news about whale restoration, because things have really changed since the 1970s. This is Dan Pauly here. He coined a term called shifting baselines in the 1990s. The idea was your baseline for what, in this case, he was talking about fisheries, let's just say the ocean, was when you started your career or a young person, that was natural. That's what you what you thought the ocean was like. So if you started your career or you were young in the 1950s, abundant, large-bodied species of fish in this case. If you started in the 1980s, though, it still looked normal to you, but there were fewer species and they were smaller. And then recently, it would be even fewer species and even smaller, right? So this is the idea, the classic idea of shifting baselines, that species are depleted over time, and we just think of that as normal. But it's not always this way. Here's the good news. For some species, it's actually going the other direction. Marine Mammal Protection Act of the United States was passed in 1972, meant no commercial hunt, no killing, no take, no direct take of marine mammals in the United States. As a consequence of that law and international agreements through the moratorium on whaling, for example, what we're seeing is marine mammal populations declined in the 1970s, but they've started to increase. So here's predatory fish up until 2010, still going down. Whale populations, and by the way, this is a back-of-the-envelope calculation that I made. Whale populations are increasing. So we're going to see that restoration. We're going to start seeing their influence on the oceans much more. 66% of U.S. marine mammal populations with known trends are increasing. An example of some species that really had a phenomenal return are bowheads in the North Pacific, down to 5,000 in 1955, now up to 11,000. Australian humpbacks, 1960, about 600 of them, now up to 25,000. Now we're talking about a species that is ecologically relevant and is playing a role in the oceans. Here's really another amazing figure, I think, which is for elephant seals. So elephant seal populations in the early 1900s may have been down to just 20 to 50 or 60 individuals. They are now this is births in the U.S. There are about 200,000 of them now. So elephant seals are doing incredibly well. They're probably back at the numbers that they were before we started hunting them. Here's what happens. If you get to it in time and you get lucky because they still have the genetic diversity in order to rebound, they can come back. Anybody think of an example here in New England? Recent rebound of a species? Yeah, exactly. Gray seal populations, they were gone from Massachusetts for a long time. They're incredibly abundant now, and they're changing the ecosystem. Many of you probably know. I mean, great white sharks are coming in to feed on them. They're having, it really is an exciting time, though there is reaction from some folks in the community that these are invasive species. They're not. They're species that are coming back. This is what we're talking about. We have to get this idea that these species were here historically. If we manage them well, the populations are going to come back over time. And the good news is they're going to have an ecological impact, but for some, that's also the bad news. You're going to start seeing them more often. We're going to be interacting with them more and more in the future. So what does this mean for the restoration of the oceans, the return of these species? This is a paper, a report that came out a couple of months ago called Fish Carbon. I wish it was called Fish and Whale Carbon, but the whales are still here, showing different ways, I'll talk about the whales here, that restoring vertebrates can have an impact on coastal ecosystems. We've discussed the whale pump. There's also the restoration of whales has impacts on trophic cascades. That is, work by Jim Estes and others have shown that when we took whales out of the system, killer whales changed their prey, because they used to feed on whales. Without the whales, they shifted and had an impact all the way to kelp forests by eating sea otters. And also, as we discussed, deadfall carbon. When whales die, they take that carbon out of the system. And then biomass. When whales and marine mammals and large fish are in the oceans, they're also storing that carbon in that area. So here's really, a hopeful way to look forward as we see more whales and more marine mammals in the system. I discussed whaling earlier today. I just want you guys, you all to realize that we also whale in the United States, but we don't do it on purpose. We kill whales, they get struck by ships, they get caught in fishing nets. So we often like to look abroad and say, why are people still killing whales? Well, we're still having an impact on whales here in the United States. How many whales are we impacting? How many marine, this is for all marine mammals, not whales. And again, this is a rough estimate. Fisheries interactions, so whales, seals, other marine mammals getting caught in fishing line, hundreds of thousands of animals are probably being killed a year. Whaling still kills thousands. Vessel collisions, an issue here in Massachusetts where we have a lot of shipping going into Boston. They're getting struck by ships, and we don't really know, I put that question, we don't really know how much sound is affecting them, at least as far as mortality. We know it affects them as far as reproduction, because whales need sound to communicate with each other, but we don't know how much it's affecting that. Rough numbers, but again, keep in mind that we're all impacting the oceans when we eat a lobster, or when we buy a car, right? These can all impact animals in the ocean. The good news is that colleagues Dave Wiley and others at Stellwagen Bank and folks at the New England Aquarium looking at right whales have come up with what is a simple but not easy fix for some of these ship strikes. So this shows you the shipping lane going into Boston until a few years ago, and red means lots of whales, right? Those dots are right whales. The red is baleen whale density in general. So what's wrong with this picture? The shipping lane goes right through the area where there are the most abundant whales in that system. So Dave Wiley and others, using GIS, said, what if we go through right here? If we put a dog leg in, that would reduce the probability of ship strikes. He had the data for this. They had long-term data on where the whales were. They knew where the ships were, and he got that through. So that's been moved. So that's a direct influence on being able to reduce those strikes. We're still going to need other ways moving forward, but it's that kind of approach that we're going to need if we're going to try and restore whale populations. And with that, I want to thank you all for coming out through the snow, and I'm happy to take any questions.
And that was Joe Roman speaking at Harvard University about the role that whales play in the ocean, the ecological role they play, and about their conservation. And I believe that was from 2016, and it was from the YouTube channel for the Harvard Museum of Natural History. And if you want to find out more about Joe Roman, who is a conservation biologist and researcher at the University of Vermont, you can go to his website, which is joeroman.com. So that's joeroman.com. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM, and we're basically out of time, so we're going to leave you with some music. So thanks for listening to the show. You can always email us at equilibrium@ckut.ca. You can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/EquilibriumCKUTMontreal. And you can check out our website at equilibriumradio.weebly.com. And there is a link to our SoundCloud page, which has some old interviews. And we have an affiliated podcast on Spotify called the Equilibrium Radio Podcast. So we're out of time, so we're going to leave you with some music now. So we're going to play you, I think we played this song last week, and we're going to play it again this week. And that is a version of Aquarius, which is from the musical Hair. And it's the special anniversary edition, which features the remastered original cast recording from 1979, and it features Galt McDermott and Tom Pearson. So this is Aquarius. Enjoy.
The 7th annual Old School Bluegrass Camp is happening this July in the beautiful Lanark Highlands of Ontario. Old School Bluegrass Camp is a summer camp for grown-ups. At camp, you'll enjoy band labs, bonfire jams, exclusive evening concerts, fresh farm-to-table meals, and world-class instruction from some of bluegrass and old time's brightest stars. So come to camp and connect with your community, find your people, and meet your new best friends. Details at oldschoolbluegrasscamp.wordpress.com.
What's going on? This is Russ.
I know I'm fine.
Russ.
But the money makes me handsome.
The Journey is Everything Tour.
If I seduce you, babe.
Saturday, May 28th, Place Bell.
Got the best song. Yeah, yeah.
Russ. With special guests, Boogies and Caitlin. Tickets on sale now at evenko.ca. Russ, the Journey is Everything Tour.
And the fans are asking for it. They're loving it. What they want, what they want, what they want.
Feel the beat!
Wait a minute, that's too fast.
Now what?
Kick it over here, baby pop!
CKUT, yo. Yo, this is for your mind, soul, and spirit. Plus your positive vibes. Masters at work, you gotta hear it. And West Indian rhythms on Saturday night. Roots, rock, reggae, I keep it tight. Manchild, hitting switches, keep it right. Decipher on a Friday. Psalms of soul, I do it my way. With ill groove on Sunday, I gotta say one way. We stick together. It's for unity in the community on CKUT at 90.3. Manchild and John Fish. We give you that musical wish to put more music in that dish. So listen to your radio station and simply turn it on. CKUT, word is born, word is born. Y'all enjoy yourselves, love you Montreal. Tune into CKUT, always.